I'm Demay Roberts, stage and studio. You're listening to music of a song by young Akha women. The Akha are an ethnic people in the Yunnan region of southern China. The Akha women are a focal point in The Tea Girl of Hummingbird Lane by Lisa C. I'll be talking with the New York Times bestselling author shortly. She's returning to Portland tomorrow night, Wednesday, at Howells Books at Cedar Hills Crossing to talk about the Akha people, the beauty of tea, and of adoption, all featured in her new book. So stay tuned. This is Stage and Studio. I'm Demay Roberts. With me on the phone is author Lisa C. Lisa, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Hey, welcome back to Stage and Studio. Are you in Seattle right now?
I am in Seattle. I wish I was sitting across from you, though.
I do,
I
too.
I love seeing you.
Yeah, and I miss you a lot. Yeah, so you're going to be in Portland, though, tomorrow night. And so I just played this beautiful music by these Akha women. I really didn't know much about the Akha before reading your book. In fact, I don't even know if I've heard much about them. And I just finished your new book, The Tea Girl of Hummingbird Lane. And what a fantastic journey that was, Lisa. That was just such a marvelous book. The amount of research and detail you include in your books continue to fascinate me. So congratulations on that.
Yeah, thank you so much. It was, I have to say, it was a big adventure for me as well, sort of personally, but just even the adventure of going up into the Tea Mountains of Yunnan and meeting, you know, Akha people, but also different peoples from other ethnic minorities who live there.
Well, did you know much about the Akha people before researching
no,
this book?
So actually, I knew that I wanted to write about the one-child policy. The story begins with a woman who has to abandon her baby, and then that baby's adopted by a family here. And then I knew I wanted to write about tea, and so I, as I was going to Yunnan, I really tried to sort of limit my scope. You know, China has 55 ethnic minorities in addition to the Han majority, who make up 55% of the country. And of those 55, 26 of them live in Yunnan. And by the time I went on the trip, I'd kind of in my mind narrowed down to about five of them. But I was really keeping an open mind, just feeling like, well, we'll see what I see and who I meet. Anyway, there came a day, this was planned, that I spent with an Akha family that was very well known for their tea. And, you know, people come, tea dealers, you know, come from all over the world to come and meet them. Anyway, the daughter, Abu, was about 30, and she actually reminded me a lot of myself in the sense that she loved to ask questions, she loved to collect stories. And so she was telling me stories about her mother and her grandmother and even her own personal story, which I ended up using quite a bit of, actually, in the novel. But she had also collected stories from her elders in her village, but also on her side of the mountain. So by the time lunchtime came around, I knew that whatever other research I had done, I was switching everything to the Akha.
Well, isn't it an amazing process, though, when you go with an open mind and maybe have a few ideas for what you want? You know you want something, and then you click on one perfect idea
that
narrows it all down. It sounds like you had that aha moment.
I did. And, you know, the Akha have a saying, no coincidence, no story. And the novel begins with that line, but I think for me, there was this sort of series of coincidences that happened that helped me make this particular story. And one of them, of course, was meeting the Akha, that one Akha family, but then, you know, doing so much more research about them. And, you know, the Akha are nomadic. They roam between Myanmar, Laos, northern Thailand, and this one province of China. They're animistic. Their culture has been described as being very similar to the Cree here in this country. What I thought was interesting, just listening to that song that you played, was how you can actually kind of hear similarities to Native American music.
There are similarities in many indigenous cultures.
This is true.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Especially when you're talking about vocal songs, because I could also hear similarity to Bulgarian singers, too.
Well,
so I think it's something about acoustic singing,
right,
choral singing.
And you're also using instruments that are coming out of natural things.
Yes,
so what's
all
around
acoustic.
You, so gourds
yes.
and drums that people make that help to create that. That very indigenous sound.
Yeah, yeah, and you know, it's, and it was beautiful to listen to. I was researching this to, you know, to play something for you actually that was related to your book. So you know, the last time we talked was 2014, and you had just completed China Dolls, which cover the history of Chinese nightclubs in Chinese American nightclubs, and it seemed immediately after that, that's when you started researching your story. I remember you were talking about you might want to do something on the one-child policy and adoption, but that's when you started researching and going to China. Now, did you want to do something specifically about tea, though, you know, before this trip?
Well, so let's backtrack.
Because it goes, you have a long journey with this book, don't you?
I did. And like I said, I think there were this series of coincidences that did lead to the story. So the first, you actually already touched on, was I was going to the movies with my husband, and we saw up ahead of us an older white couple walking with their teenage daughter, adopted from China, between them. She had this long ponytail, and it was swinging back and forth, and I had this vision of her as being kind of like a fox spirit in that family. And a fox spirit in Chinese culture can be very mischievous, very naughty, but in their best moments, they have this ability to bring great love and to create a family. And so when I saw her, even though I had been thinking about writing about the one-child policy and transnational adoption literally for decades, in that moment when I saw that foxtail swinging back and forth, I thought, this is the moment. But, of course, I write historical novels, and so this didn't sound too historical in my mind, but I didn't worry about it too much because I know things happen in kind of mysterious ways. And a couple of months later, I was giving a talk at a library, and they had brought in a Chinese tea master to do a tea demonstration before my talk. He was kind of the opening act. And I got to sit up on the stage with him, and he was pouring one particular tea, pu'er, and talking about tea in general, and then this pu'er in particular. And so, you know, tea is the second most popular drink in the world after water, and he talked about how tea shrubs are, no matter where you go in the world, are clones, but in Yunnan, they have the original tea trees, and he talked about the tea horse road and about this one kind of tea in particular and how it had grown so much in value. And then he ended with one point, which was that just that year, so now 3 years ago, there was one cake of this pu'er tea, a little under a pound, that had sold at international auction for $150,000.
Amazing.
And when I heard that, I thought, ah, now I know my historic backdrop.
Oh, there's a story there, right?
Yeah.
There's a huge story there.
Yeah.
I want to talk to you more about the pu'er tea. I have a few questions, but I just want to remind listeners you're listening to Sage and Studio. I'm Dee Mae Roberts talking with author Lisa C., who's just published her new book, The Tea Girl of Hummingbird Lane, and she's going to be talking about her book at Powell's Books at Cedar Hills Crossing this Wednesday, tomorrow night, April 12th at 7 p.m., and that's located at 3415 Southwest Cedar Hills in Beaverton. Now, Lisa, you know, I did not know much. I don't even know if I've even heard of pu'er tea. And I learned so much about that just reading your book and the exquisite details that you had about how it's grown, where it's grown, you know, how it's made and how it's made into tea cakes. I mean, this was all very new to me. And it sounds like it was new to you, too.
It was new to me, and I feel like I have been a tea drinker all my life.
Oh, me too. Yeah.
So, but I had never heard of this tea except that I'd actually had a lot of it. So, pu'er is the Mandarin name, pone is the name in Cantonese, and so This is a tea that, you know, among other places that it went in China, was out to Hong Kong and Guangzhou. And that's where Cantonese food is from. That's where my family is from. And if you've had dim sum, you know it can be kind of greasy. And so people have always liked to drink this tea because it has this ability to kind of cut through grease. And so,
I probably have drank it before then,
right.
And not realized it.
Yeah, and just not even known it. And so, I even as I was working on the novel, and it wasn't too far in, but there was a point when I was talking to someone in my family, and they said, "Well, you know what you're talking about. You've had that tea before."
Interesting.
But I don't think what I had had in restaurants as a little girl was quite the same quality as that, from that tea cake that was $150,000.
Yeah, because it's highly coveted, and it can be quite expensive.
Right.
You know, and in fact, you know, that, you know, I want to ask you for advice later on about where to get it that isn't too expensive, you know, but is still good. But you probably had to learn about the different qualities, and you went to the, when you were in Yunnan, you went to different places to, I guess, you know, to learn about tea. So you went to a tea farm and where they were making it and rolling it by hand.
Right, and I actually learned every step of the tea making process, from how to pick leaves. Then you put them out for their sun bath. That's easy. Then you you cook them in a wok, this big outdoor wok, that you're kind of kneading the leaves and tossing them in this wok. It's very hard, hot, heavy work. And then you actually knead it on baskets, and then it sits again. And then with this tea, what makes it different from every other tea in the world is that it has the ability to age. So this is going to be very bad news for your listeners, that if they have any tea in their cupboards that's over 6 months old, it really, they should just throw it out, because it doesn't have the
flavor, tell me that,
or the taste anymore. But this tea ages, and over time it kind of ferments. It's not that it's alcoholic, but it does change its nature. And so the most valuable teas are the ones that have aged naturally. And this is a lot like wine, in the sense that, you know, it grows in value with time. And so you can buy a tea that's 10 years, 20, 30, 50 years old. And, of course, those are the ones that are more expensive. But you, they also have the raw tea, the raw pu'er, which has really just gone through a three-day process of this sun bath and killing the green and all of that, and then it's just sitting naturally. And I, in many ways, prefer that. It has a very light, grassy taste, whereas the ones that are older, and sometimes you can buy them naturally fermented, where they've just been sitting by themselves for all those years, or they're artificially fermented. And they have a richer, kind of earthy feeling to them, where you're supposed to taste like the forest floor or bark or old wood. I think of it as the difference between like a light Pinot Grigio and then a really, you know, rich Cabernet.
Well, you talked about
the same leaf. It's just how it's been aged and how it's been cared for over the years will produce a very different taste,
and probably how it's brewed as well.
That's right.
Yeah, you know, you talk a lot about that now. You know, it's become more, I don't want to say trendy, but, you know, it's more popular now, and people have tea tastings as they do wine tastings, you know.
That's right.
So it really is highly coveted. Now, Lisa, I you know, I'd love talking about tea, to tell you the truth, and, you know, I could almost taste it as you're talking about it, and I certainly could when you were reading it, when I was reading your book. But I also want to talk about your main characters in your book, and one of them, the lead character is an Akka woman named Li Yang. Is that correct, how I'm pronouncing it?
Mm-hmm.
And so it sounds like when you met this one family that, you know, was that the inspiration for the character of Li Yang and what she went through, in the process of your book?
Well, so the fictional character, Li Yang, ends up, is pregnant and not married and gives birth to a baby and has to give that baby away, because in the Aka culture, they have this concept of human rejects, and certainly a child born out of wedlock would count in under that category. So to save her baby, she takes the baby down off the mountain and to the nearest town. It's the first time she's seen what we might think of as civilization, you know, lights and cars and things like that. Her journey later, as the book progresses, as she knows that she no longer has a life on Nano Mountain and she has to leave, from there, that really does parallel the life of the woman that I interviewed and sort of how she comes down the mountain, the details of being on the truck, going all the way to Kunming. This woman that I interviewed was, you know, went to a trade school in Kunming, was so poor, you know, her parents had saved money for her to go, and they thought, oh, she only needs 200 yuan a month, but everybody else had 800 to live on. So she was hungry all the time. And the one thing she had was the tea that her mother sent her, which she would give to her teachers. And so a couple of years into her schooling, the government of Yunnan started a new Puer Tea College.
So this is all true.
Yeah, so that's all true. And yeah. So this woman that I interviewed, Abu, she was the only ethnic minority to be admitted into both programs of the tea college. So one had to do with tea tasting and becoming a tea master, and the other one had to do with how you make this tea. So those kinds of details, and then how she then goes on to Guangzhou and has her tea shop, all of those come from her. And I think that that's one reason why those details feel so
real
and personal,
yeah.
Because they were.
They were real. Yeah, I'm actually a little bit surprised to hear that. But, you know, not so surprised, because I read your other books and how much you really take the research that you research to really invest it into your book in creating these characters. So much of that, you know, whether it's composite or not, you know, is there's so much that you can learn from reading your books that is real, that is true. So, yeah, it's great to hear that story. You know, there's so much about breaking from cultural traditions and modernization. And I don't want to give away too much about some of the shocking things that happen, especially with the birth of twins. But I'm just thinking there's so much of those kind of details of how she adjusts to this new life and, you know, while still, you know, maintaining such a strong tie to her village, to her mom especially, you know, to the traditions that she grew up with.
Right. I think for many of us, don't we experience that we have traditions, whether they're in our family or, you know, maybe related to the whatever religion that we've grown up with, but sometimes we come to a place where we start to reject them.
Oh, Lisa,
yes,
we're having some interference here. Did you move to a certain area?
No, I'm still sitting in the
same. Well, maybe you should. I don't know if that would change. So, yeah, you were breaking up, you know?
Yeah, and it's a landline.
Yeah, it's not getting any better. Yeah, because we lost all of that you were talking about. Let me ask you a different question. I was wondering about the adoptee story, because I want to get that in before we end today. That, you know, you've got Liang's story, and then you've also got another story, which is the baby that Liang, gave up, that was adopted by American parents. And we hear, you know, we read her story through letters, through emails, transcripts. Why did you choose that particular narrative to tell the story of the adoptee?
Well, you know, I realize every time I talk, you get static. Are you still hearing me?
Yeah, I'm still hearing static. How about, do you want to try calling? We'll just hang up for a little bit, and I'll talk more about your book and give the announcement about your reading, and then we'll recall you. Is that going to work?
That sounds good.
All right.
Okay.
So Lisa C. is going to be in Portland, and that's tomorrow night. And thank you, listeners, for sticking in with me. This is live radio, you know, so things like this do happen. But just know that you're listening to a very special broadcast right now and hearing about our technical difficulties, but also being able to master them. So you're listening to Stage and Studio. I'm Dee Mae Roberts, and I'm talking with author Lisa C., and she just published her new book, The Tea Girl of Hummingbird Lane. It's quite a sumptuous book. I really enjoyed reading her work, as always. And she's going to be talking about this book and all of the things that she's been talking about in this interview about their tea research and about transnational adoption and about the Aka people at Powell's Books at Cedar Hills Crossing, and that's this Wednesday, April 12th. That's tomorrow night at 7 p.m., and that's located at 3415 Southwest Cedar Hills in Beaverton. And you can find more info at powellsbooks.com, and I have that info and a link at stageandstudio.org and kbu.fm/stageandstudio. And, you know, I think that, you know, I hope that you get to see her. Her talks are so interesting, just like her interviews, because she has done so much research. In the meantime, I also want to announce something else that's happening that same night. I hate to miss Lisa's talk, but I also am showing, I'm having a showing and a reading for Authors Night at South Waterfront in Portland, and that's tomorrow night, April 12th. So I'm sorry to miss her, but so go see her. But if you can't, you know, come see me. I'm screening my autobiographical film, May May, A Daughter's Song. It's an adaptation of my radio documentary, and I'll be reading from my memoir collection, The Letting Go Trilogy, Stories of a Mixed Race Family. And that's tomorrow night, Wednesday, April 12th at 7 p.m. at the John Ross Tower in South Waterfront. And that's located at 3601 Southwest River Parkway. 3601 Southwest River Parkway. More info at southwaterfront.com. And I'll post that info at kbu.fm/stageandstudio and stageandstudio.org. Now, we're still waiting to see if we can talk with the last remaining minutes with Lisa C., and we're on hold right now. There's another announcement that I'd like to make, too, and that's for Triangle Productions. They're doing something interesting, a new play about the loss of undocumented workers, and it's called Building the Wall, and it's by Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright Robert Schenken. It's a harrowing drama about the consequences of Donald Trump's anti-immigration campaign rhetoric. Yeah, yeah, yeah. The shows are April 20th through the 29th at 7:30 p.m. at Triangle Productions, and there's more info about that at tripro.org. Now, I hear from my engineer that we do have Lisa C. back. Lisa, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Oh, hang up.
But you also have something
again.
Now, like in the background, about hanging up.
You know, this is the beauty of live radio, Lisa. So, you know,
okay,
we just have to roll with the punches, right? So in the time remaining, I was asking you about the narrative of the adoptee Haley and, you know, and how she, you know, is presented, you know, almost like a mystery, you know, that we have
right.
to sort of find her through her letters, her emails, her transcripts. Why did you choose that narrative?
I thought, you know, as a baby, she can't speak for herself.
True.
But other people
yeah.
would.
Yeah.
And so you have a report from the woman who runs the adoption agency, and then letters from her, the doctors, the specialists who take care of her because she's so ill when she first arrived, and emails between her adoptive mother and her adoptive grandmother, until finally you start to hear Haley in her own voice, you know, a birthday card that she writes to her mother, some spelling words and sentences that she does in third grade. I will tell you straight up, I stole them straight from my son.
Uh-oh.
But until you get to a chapter, it's not her last chapter, but I think it's my favorite chapter, which is a transcript of a group therapy session for teenage girls who've been adopted from China.
And that was real? That was a real transcript?
Well, it's not a real transcript, but how I put it together was that I interviewed young women all around the country who had been adopted from China. Not little girls, but sort of 18 to 22 years old. People who had sort of, you know, had a sense, it's not a long time, but a sense of a journey, and they have struggled a lot, and a lot of their issues have to do with identity. You know, what am I? Am I Chinese? Am I American? Am I Chinese-American? Or am I something else? But their issues have been greater than that, and they even have their own label, the Grateful But Angry Adoptee. And after having interviewed so many of them and, you know, taking excerpts from those interviews and using them in that transcript, I came to the realization that it's less grateful but angry. Rather, it's grateful but sad. And this was summed up for me by one young woman who said, "I know I'm the most precious person in my family. I know it. But I wasn't precious enough for my birth family to keep me as their one child."
Well, you know, I've heard that quite a bit. There is a sense of loss, you know, as well as gratitude, because it's such a complex situation. And in fact, it's, you know, I don't want to give away the ending of your book. There seemed to me there was another story to be told, you know, especially more about transnational adoption. Do you think there will be a sequel to this book?
I don't think so.
Damn!
But I, you know, the ending, I've been hearing really interesting comments about that. And some people love it just as it is, and some people do want to know what happens next.
Right.
But the way I looked at it was that whatever happens next, that how great for a reader to sort of continue that journey in their imagination of what would happen next.
Well, Lisa C., you know, I think it's, you know, just incredible the work that you've done, and I look forward. I know you're probably already thinking about the next one, but probably not. Who knows?
Oh,
you're probably
done. I'm about 90 pages into it.
Oh, okay. Well, I look forward to that, too. Do you want to give any hints about it?
Sure. It's actually the first book that I will have written that's not about China or the Chinese-American experience.
Interesting.
There's an island off the tip of South Korea that's a matrifocal society. It's not a matriarchy, but the society is focused on women. And for 1,000 years, these women were free divers, and they would dive down on a single breath down about 60 feet, stay underwater for about 2 minutes, which is pretty remarkable,
yeah,
and harvest seafood and take care of their families. They were the breadwinners, and their husbands looked after the kids, cleaned the house, did the laundry. And so it used to be that there were, you know, the women would retire at age 50, but now the youngest ones are about 55. So last year I was there and I interviewed women who were in their 80s and 90s and still diving.
Wow. Well, looking forward to that. You know, you live an amazing life. You choose an area and you can go there and do your research. And it's really, you know, it's work, but it's also like quite an amazing adventure. So kudos to you. That sounds fantastic. It's always a pleasure to talk with you, Lisa. And I won't be able to see you tomorrow night because of my reading, but I want to encourage people to see you tomorrow night and start reading your book. It will be tomorrow night, April 12th, 7 p.m. at Powell's at Cedar Hill Crossing, 3415 Southwest Cedar Hills in Beaverton. Lisa C., thank you so much for chatting with us on Stage and Studio despite the difficulties. Have a great visit to Portland tomorrow night.
Thank you so much. Nice.
Take care. And so I'm Demet Roberts, this is Stage and Studio. Before we go today, a shout out to Artist Repertory Theater for presenting an important work that remembers the Rodney King verdict and subsequent uprising in Los Angeles nearly 25 years ago. Artist Rep will present Rodney King, written and performed by acclaimed actor and performance artist Roger Guinevere Smith. This production at Artist Rep will be the final stage production performances of Smith's piece. It's been touring since 2012. And Netflix is actually doing a film version of it, directed by Spike Lee and with Roger Guinevere Smith. Let's hear a clip.
But it's Saturday night, right? You got a job to go to on Monday morning, so you're going to celebrate. You're going to hit that 40 time, 40 time, 40 time, 40, and you're going to step outside. You're going to take a joy ride, so you step outside with your boys into the ride. It's a what? White Hyundai? Oh, you know what they say about a white Hyundai. If you're going to get into a high-speed chase with the CHP LAPD, you might not want to do it in a white Hyundai. Well, you turn up the sound, right? Now, what are you listening to? Public Enemy? Oh, no. Not Public Enemy. What you listening to? NWA? The Police? Oh, no. You from L.A. NWA. That would be a cliche. No, you listening to De La Soul. From the Soul. Black Medallions. No go. Hanging out with Paz. Hanging out with Mace. Buddy, buddy, buddy. All in my face. Turn it down, Glenn. That's what they call you then. Right? Glenn? Your family and your friend and them. They call you Glenn. Rodney King had not yet been invented. You were Glenn then to your family and friend. Turn it down, Glenn. But you're not going to turn it down. Hell no. You're going to turn it up. Because you've been hitting that 40 time, 40 time, 40 time, 40 time, 40 time, 40 time, 40, and you're hitting the accelerator.
And that's Rodney King by Roger Gunvor Smith. That's a clip from a show. Four performances only at Artist Repertory Theater, April 21st through the 23rd, Friday through Saturday at 7:30 p.m., Sunday at 2 p.m. at Artist Rep, located at the Alder Stage, 1516 Southwest Alder Street in Portland. For tickets, call 503-241-1278 or visit artistrep.org. And I'm going to have all of that info on Stage and Studio's web pages. That's it for Stage and Studio. Thank you to engineer Tave Fashe Drake. And I'll have this show later online today at stageandstudio.org, kbu.fm/stageandstudio, as well as the podcast on iTunes, and like us on facebook.com/stageandstudio or tweet me at stageandstudio. Till next time, I'm Dee Mae Roberts.